begin by commenting briefly on the question of where are we as the pay boards and presentations are now coming into the picture. There are, I think, clearly indications that there is a diminution in the rate of inflation. The consumer price index for September, for example, was announced approximately 3 months ago, as I recall, and it showed a 0.2% rise. But I think the more interesting thing is that of approximately 4,000 non-food commodity prices priced for the usual index, 87% of the prices remained unchanged, and 6% went down, or in other words, 93% of all of the 4,000 prices either remained unchanged or declined 8% went up, and much of the rise in the 0.2, which is hardly statistically significant, could be explained by such factors as that some of the items in the consumer price index are not actually priced every month, such as college tuition, which is priced once a year, and of course came into the index in September, or import prices went up some, both because they are not controlled, and because the surcharge could be passed through and so forth. So at least there is a trend that has been, I think, good. The freeze itself, the wage price freeze itself, has been well accepted. And I think it has been generally fairly well run. This is a tribute to a man who has become the elder statesman of that operation, Harvey Weber. Unquestionably confront one of the great challenges of public service in this century.
Thankless job, but but in our report.
I decided to begin my own evaluation by making an admission of something that many of you wouldn't hear. And this is absolutely something that you cannot deny. When we announced this wage board price commission, the energy committee, et cetera, et cetera, many of the specifics who analyzed the situation for us, said, well, this is fuzzy, it's uncertain. The answer is, of course it is, and it will continue to be, and it has to be. We can make it not fuzzy and very certain. But the way to make it not fuzzy and very certain is to have a system of absolute control throughout the economy. Rather than having basically a system which will have behind it the strong compliance machinery, and a system that depends upon existing government personnel for the most part, policing, a system that depends primarily upon massive public voluntary support to make it go, rather than having that, of course, we can have a massive office of controls for wages and prices. What would that cost? Well, it would cost, of course, the money to get at the employment problem. Take at least $50,000 to have an adequate wage OPA organization at this time, at least 50,000 new people, a new agency. But the cost that concerns me the most, and the reason we've taken this road, is the cost that would be involved in taking this, what I believe is this vibrant, potentially powerful economy of ours, and putting it in a straitjacket, signing its capability for growth and life, and then running into a situation where we would do such damage to it that it might not recover, or on the other side of the coin, that people could become so used to controls that they might resign themselves to continue. Let me start at the other end of the spectrum. If there's anything I believe very, very strongly, is the future of this country lies not in the roof of more and more government controls, but less. And so having said that, if you were to poll a majority of the American people today, a majority would be for wage controls and price controls. As a matter of fact, the majority very strongly supported the wage price freeze when I announced it, because they thought, well, it's going to stop rising the cost of living so far. That is true at the beginning. But when we look at what happens to controls, our own experience in this country, the experience abroad, we all have to reach the conclusion that the rigid, regimented government control route is not the best route for this country if we want to continue to expand, to lead the world in our economy. So consequently, we have set this up on a basis where we do have sanctions. Understand, as you know, we have asked the Congress for sanctions. But we do have a price commission in the way for it. We expect to do a job, but also set up on the basis where we hope that over a period of time, we can move away from the control system to an economy that can operate without free atmosphere. So having set that goal, I want to say that that makes your job all the more hard, all the harder. It's very easy, really, to take a system where every I is dotted and every T is crossed. But when you know, you have all the rules and regulations, when somebody asks you questions, as well, there is the problem, you don't do this, whack, and so forth. Or you've got enough personnel and police and so forth around the country. That's simple. Much clearer to do it. headed by a top clerk. But a system like this is very different. A system like this requires leaders, requires men and women who can enable public support, persuaders, setting. The program will fail if we have to rely too much on the compliance as far as government is concerned. If we have to rely too much on the sanctions of government, then, in my view, this will fall its own weight. So what we really come down to is your responsibility in passing measures waiting for it to take this very, very difficult assignment, look at some objectives, make them realistic, then proceed to find a way to implement those objectives without the installation of massive controls. I would like to tell all of you that getting you to serve the boards that you were the only ones we had. It's not true. In fact, we wanted all of you. You were at. But I can tell you that there are many people in this country, prophets, executives, the rest, who didn't have the guts to take this on. They're afraid it might not work. For that reason, I just want to say that I appreciate the fact that around this table we have sustained them and that know that this is a difficult problem, that know that it's necessary for the country if we're going to have the economy without this period of inflation that destroys all the goals we have, and who yet will take the assignment on public business. I think you're going to succeed. You're going to have total backing from the White House. You'll have my total backing from whatever that may be able to contribute. I will, of course, be here. You will meet the cost of the council. I will, time to time, of course, have to take this something back you up and maybe something else for the sake. Whatever the case may be, I do realize that you, and particularly those who accepted the responsibilities of chairman in both instances, you're making great sacrifice. You're taking great risks. The reputations that you have, and you all have fine reputations, are on the line, that I am most grateful for, and the country will be most grateful. Looking down the road, just one final word, I just spoke to a group of women at the Sheridan Park who are very interested in many things, bees, all the great ideals that motivates all of our people, but particularly women, concerned about their children, but also across the rest. And I made this point that we're in a very interesting and, to use almost a cliche word, historic period in American foreign policy. We're ending a war, it's difficult, and longer than our history. But we're doing something that we haven't done adequately after the other wars that we've been in. We are looking far down the road in attempting to build a peace. In fairness, let me say, Wilson tried to, after World War I, and failed because of lack of cooperation and the response on both sides. And then after World War II, we had the United Nations. But too many hopes were raised for an organization that could never be solved. No great powers would submit its fate to 150 small nations. And so therefore, that is going to, that it is important. But since the United Nations, since World War II, and all those great hopes, the United States had two wars, one in Korea and one in Vietnam. So when you finally come down to it, we have to look at the power structure in the world. We continue to support the United Nations, we work with our friends in Europe, our friends in Latin America, our friends in Africa. But where the game is going to be determined is what happens between the United States and the Soviet Union today and the next immediate future. And looking further down the line between the United States and the Soviet Union and the other great superpower, mainly China. That's why I'm taking the trip to China. That's why I'm taking the trip to the Soviet Union. these are those trips you're going to meet, but after them, the United States, Americans, Russians, and Chinese, particularly our leaders, who might all agree on everything. We have great differences, philosophical differences, historical differences that will never be resolved. We're destined to be competitors in the world. Maybe what it is to compete without war, not only between ourselves, but simulating other parts of the world. And so, we're in this period of time where there's still a great deal, of course, to a danger, but where I think we can say that the easiest problem is ending the one war. Then we come to the more difficult problem, problems of the relations between the superpowers of the United States and Soviet Union. Can we have an agreement on Europe? Can we have an agreement limiting arms? Can we have an agreement that might cool off the Middle East? All these things. And further down the line between the United States and mainland China. On all of these fronts, I can only say that there is now greater hope than there's been at any time in this century, mainly because great forces are propelling, for different reasons in some instances and for the same reason in another, that same reason being the fear of a nuclear confrontation that each nation has toward talking rather than fighting. Once that happens, let us suppose that in the last third of the century we had what we have not had in any generation in this century, a period of peace for the United States. What does it mean? It will be a period of the greatest challenge this country has had since it began. Let me describe it, if I can, in terms of sports. I'm somewhat of a sports buff, you know, football, baseball, bowling, you name it. I try it all, failed it all, I also follow track. A few of you around this table are old enough to remember the 1924 and the 1928 Olympics. You remember Paolo Nermi, the great Finnish runner. He was never beaten. He never broke 4 minutes, the minor. The reason he never broke 4 minutes, he didn't have any competitors. He used to run with the Wichita Ranch. And that's before they had Ravage, you know, and now all great 4 minute miners, they got one guy who turns out in his first quarter, and another runs the second quarter, and another runs the third quarter, and as a result, they press themselves beyond what they thought were the barriers of human endurance to run 353, 352, 355. Sort of routine. Here's their probably could have been the first man to break 4 minutes. But he ran under wristwatch, and he timed himself as a runner. And still did very well. Nobody beat him. He ran 403, I think it was his best time. The United States, in a sense, since World War II, up until 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even up until now, has been running with a wristwatch. Nobody really could compete with us after World War II. We were so preeminent for it. Who would have dreamed that the Russians and the Japanese, who were prospering as we stand in World War II, would now be our two major competitors in the free world, which they are. Who would have dreamed that Europe, so divided after World War II, now probably is going to get together. You're going to have 300 million people, the greatest, most powerful trading bloc in the world. Yes. And looking further down the road, looking at Asia, whatever we want to say about the Chinese economy, it is not, at the present time, particularly important because it produces only one half of the Japanese economy. Does. 750 million Chinese, if you've ever been to Taiwan or Singapore, or if you've ever been to Hong Kong and seen what Chinese people can do, as the world opens up and as they compete, they're going to be enormous competitors. Needless to say, the Russians will be, even with their lousy systems. So here's the new world that we're in now. This is just the United States. There are five runners in this race in the great industrial race. There's the United States. There's the 300 million people of Western Europe. There are the 300 million people in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. There are 1 billion people looking ahead, 750 million people in China. And there's Japan. Those are the great runners, that's all. Latin America is important, Africa is and so forth, but that's further down the road. Now what does that all mean to us? What it means is that the United States at this time, this can't afford to be fast. We can't afford to be inefficient. can't afford to be non-competitive. That is one of the reasons why we have to get this inflationary problem. We have to get it the wage cost spiral. We've got to get it the problem of inefficiencies generally in our economy. We've got to get it the problem of government. That's one of the reasons why reorganization of government. Government is the most inefficient organization in the country today. I know, because I head the government. It's lousy. It's terrible. And that's one of the reasons we're trying to reform it. But a lot of business is inefficient, too. No amount of labor is inefficient. And at this time, if the United States, the kind of a race that we're in economically, is not thin and strong and vigorous and efficiency, others are going to pass us by. Oh, I know there are many who will say, forget it. We don't worry about that. Still a war on ourselves. Many welcomed my August 15th speech for the wrong reason. They said, listen, great, we're going to have a 10% switch charge. Finally, these burners aren't going to be able to compete with us anymore. We can build a war on ourselves. We can have ports. We can make them permanent. We can say that the low cost abroad cannot compete with the United States. We're not going to be allowed to again. But any nation that builds its wall around itself ceases to be a great nation. We've got to stay in the race. So this brings me back from the mountaintop to where we are right now in the value of the work. Your work is a lot bigger than simply this wage board, price board, and you're going to be damned in the press and say, oh, this fuzzy thing. Why did they come up with that? Why did they do that? But in this very difficult period, you can do Hydel, glad to see you.
Sir, I'm sorry. Where are you?
That's a place to come from. You can make a contribution to mitigating this wage price spiral into this difficult period. You can make that contribution in such a way that we can continue to have a strong, free American economy. This is really worthwhile. So I'm simply saying to you, the job is tough, it's thankless, you shouldn't have taken it, but I'm glad you did.
Now that's what's affecting that individual. poll is taken two ways. And how are things in the country, how are things in your neighborhood? And you get different responses as those questions are asked. The neighborhood, everything is pretty good. Country, everything's all to hell. And so it's a matter of perception of the individual. Now, I'll come back to this, but I want to call out the fact that taxes and education rank in the top four here, and that bears on what we'll be talking about as to the specific proposal. Okay?